to Open Minds Radio with Alejandro Rojas. Open Minds Radio is your UFO news authority, presenting evidence and the latest news regarding the UFO phenomenon. Here's your host, Alejandro Rojas.
Hey, that's me. Here's Tucker. Oh, yeah, the show's starting. Oh, my gosh. It's Alejandro. How are you? This is Open Minds Radio, and we're really happy to have you with us again. We weren't able to be here last week. I actually had some family in town, and I selfishly took the day off, denying you your regular weekly dose of Open Minds Radio. And I do humbly apologize, but we're really happy to be back. And you're going to get more than you ever wanted. Nah, we'll leave them wanting more. Don't worry about it. Of Jason and I, because this is one of our UFO news specials. And really, I've been wanting to do this. We've been wanting to do this ever since the Congress, but we kind of had some other cool stuff going on, so we've had some other people on the show. Of course, the Phoenix Lights anniversary was earlier in March, so we're able to get around to it. Now, we are going to have a really cool show next week, but we've already got that lined up, and that is David Paris, who's actually a University of Nebraska professor. He actually teaches on several topics at several schools, including physics and astronomy and geology. Very intelligent person, and we'll be talking about the science of UFOs. In fact, he has his very own theories, very good ones, by the way, on UFOs and their propulsion. And you may have heard some people, the Bermuda Triangle, where there's been at least one instance where a plane kind of went into this tunnel of clouds and then had kind of a, like the opposite of missing time, where all of a sudden he was a lot further than he should have been. And David Paris has a theory about this, very technical. And he thinks that this is what these UFOs are using as propulsion. Very interesting stuff. So this is going to be a lot of fun. Next week, talking to David Paris. This week, we're going to talk a lot about all the news that we've got to catch up with because, you know, the last couple of shows have been pretty long. We had Grant Cameron, and we kind of cut the news short in order to get all that, and then we didn't have news last week. So let's get into all of the news that is fit to print on UFOs, and we have with us this guy who is just really extraordinary at what he does, and that is Jason McClellan, our UFO news correspondent. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Alejandro. UFO news time, huh?
That's right.
It has been a while.
All day, every day.
We haven't had a chance to do our usual UFO chat, and there's been some interesting stuff that I've definitely wanted to talk with you about.
Yeah, very much.
I wanted to start with this one just because you and I were just talking about the UK. So I'll start with this one, but kind of an interesting story. A counselor from Yorkshire, England, claims his real mother was an extraterrestrial. His name is Simon Parks, and he was elected to Whitby Town Council in February as a Labour Party candidate. And he says he met a 9-foot-tall green extraterrestrial when he was only 6 months old. And this extraterrestrial claimed to be his real mother. He alleges he has had more than 100 extraterrestrial visitations during his lifetime. And according to the Yorkshire Post, Parks has been the, quote, subject of horrific alien operations and had an implant put into his hand by the creatures. Parks also claims that at age 11, his extraterrestrial mother took him aboard a UFO. His extraterrestrial beliefs were reportedly not an issue that was raised during his campaign. That's surprising. But according to the Northern Echo, Park states, quote, it's a personal matter and it doesn't affect my work.
Mm-hmm. When did this news first come out? Did it come out before his campaign?
I don't know. I mean, he says that it wasn't an issue. I certainly hadn't heard about it until maybe a week or two ago, but I know after digging into it a little bit, I know that the story's been out there. He certainly, if you look on YouTube, he's got a bunch of videos where he's talking in detail about these encounters with extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't seem to be a recent happening, but, you know, I guess in politics, especially in the United States, the only thing that matters is if there was a sexual encounter.
Well, that's not all that really. They've had that MP in Europe. I mean, this poor guy has really got harassed, and he's just written books about UFOs and ETs and other paranormal subjects. And this guy, his...
That's right.
That
was pretty big news.
Yeah. And his moving into his post as an MP has been delayed because of his beliefs. And so, yeah, they were harsh with this poor guy. So it's interesting that this guy seems to be getting not as bad treatment as the other one.
And his stories are more extreme.
Yeah.
You know, actual encounters and repeated encounters and implants. His actual mother is an extraterrestrial, so...
Yeah, that's pretty heavy stuff.
And unusual descriptions, too. I mean, you don't... Nowadays, you don't really hear of green extraterrestrials that much. And certainly not... With his description, and it's interesting that he recalls some of these memories from when he was 6 months old. You know, that's pretty impressive. I don't know many people who recall memories from when they were 6 months old. But he specifically recalls this green extraterrestrial had eight fingers, and it put eight-fingered hand on him. So a tall green extraterrestrial with eight fingers on each hand. Interesting description that we don't hear all that often.
Yeah, pretty, I don't know what to make of this whole thing.
I don't either, and it's surprising there hasn't been more news about it, so I don't know, you know, if it was perhaps, I don't know. I don't know what the point would have been of a publicity stunt or anything this long after his election, but interesting. We'll see if anything more comes out about that. And I don't know how much more time I want to devote to it, but there are more videos of him discussing his details of all of this, and I've only kind of breezed through them. So I'll see if there's anything more to pull from those videos, but... I think I've gone over the highlights so far. All right. Well, Alejandro, this is something that you and I like to talk about a lot, and that is space news with the search for extraterrestrial life. And there was some really exciting news last week. New data from the European Southern Observatory's HARPS, that's High Accuracy Radio Velocity Planet Searcher, planet hunting telescope, suggests there could be tens of billions of Earth-like planets in our galaxy. Astronomers analyzing this new data estimate that approximately 40% of red dwarf stars in the Milky Way galaxy may have Earth-sized planets orbiting them with the right conditions for life. Red dwarfs constitute nearly 80% of the stars in the galaxy, and according to Wired.com, their pervasiveness means, quote, that there are tens of billions of possible places to look for life beyond Earth, with at least 100 such planets located nearby. During this recent survey of red dwarf stars, scientists discovered a planet in the Gliese 667 triple star system. This is the second planet discovered in that system and has been named Gliese 667 capital C little c. And just a quick note here, from what I understand, the naming, even though it's very bland, the names they choose for these things are very unexciting. But the notations, the letter notations there, the capital C and little c, indicate that the first C would indicate the number of stars. So because there are three stars in that system, A, B, and C, this is in the third star, the C star. And then the second C in there, and I don't know why they duplicate this, but they do. So in the little C's, the first A would be the star. They've already notated the star. So the first planet would be A, would be B, and the second planet would be C. So this is the second planet in that system. So it's notated with a C.
Still a boring name.
It's a horrible name, but at least there's some sense to the
logic.
Medicine. Yeah. So the planet is situated near the center of the habitable zone, and according to astronomers, it, quote, almost certainly has the right conditions for the existence of liquid water on its surface. Gliese 667, capital C, little c, is the second super-Earth planet located in the habitable zone of a red dwarf star discovered during the HARPS survey. The first was Gliese 581d, which was confirmed in 2009. And that is not to be confused with Gliese 581G that we've talked about a lot on the show. Well, mainly 2 years ago, we talked most about that. But that was an exciting discovery, almost discovery. It's still debatable, I believe, that 581G even exists.
No,
but,
really?
But the people who discovered it claimed that it was in the habitable zone, and that's when we started talking about, really, that was the start of us talking about planets in the habitable zone. But it's since been debated as to whether the planet G actually exists. But 581D was confirmed in 2009. But with more information coming from ESO's HARPS and what we talk about most, NASA's Kepler Space Telescope, and current data continuing to be analyzed by astronomers, they're still getting information in from these sources, and they have information they've already received from years past that they're still going through. Incredible discoveries about the galaxy are, in my opinion, certain to become more common, and each new discovery helps us discover more, and perhaps brings us closer to finding extraterrestrial life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's a safe bet for you to say certain, because we keep seeing these on nearly a daily basis, a weekly basis.
Certainly a weekly basis, yeah.
I mean, the one you just mentioned, the Goldilocks zone, for people who know, they call it Goldilocks because it's not too hot for water to be in a gaseous form, not too cold for water to be in a solid form, but it's in a liquid state, which, as far as our example of our planet, we know that water is an important component here for life. But that's what's interesting. Some of the dwarf stars are talking about, some of these stars that aren't even around a sun, that some of these could have the right configuration where water, the planet's warm enough because of gravity and all these other factors, that water would be liquid there. So what we call the Goldilocks zone is where Kepler and lots of these other people are looking for planets that most likely would have life. But they're finding that there are probably planets or could be planets with life, or at least the right components to harbor life outside of the Goldilocks zone. So this number of how many planets could be habitable keeps increasing and increasing.
It's going to spiral out of control because, mm-hmm. again, as you pointed out, I mean, this is looking for planets that are in the habitable zone based on life as we know it. So that's really what is being targeted. And when we discover new environments where certain types of life can be sustained, that's going to increase this search zone that these different tools are looking for. So.
Mm-hmm. So it's really exciting. I mean, I don't know if I mentioned that on the last show. I wrote a story for the magazine. Of course, stuff is happening so quick, and it used to not be like this. You know, you could feel pretty safe that there won't be another discovery in the next couple months or in the next 6 months. But we have them on a weekly basis where I wrote the story like a month ago that's going to be in the magazine in another month. And already there's been a couple more discoveries that I wasn't able to get in there. But still, this story gives you some more history about SETI, what SETI's doing, what Kepler is doing, and what some of these other groups are doing, such as this group out of the Smithsonian who found a planet themselves looking at different data. And this planet is very close. They decided to look at close stars, relatively close stars. And this one's like 27 light years away, and there's a water world there. And so they think there could be life there. And they're shocked and excited because if we sent a probe there, it would only take, with today's technology, maybe a couple hundred years to get there. So may or may not be worth doing, considering what technology we may have by then. We may be able to visit there ourselves, but still, that even this guy was shocked because he says it was easier to find this than it should have been. We thought it would take us a long time, and boom, first system we look at, and here's a planet that is in the Goldilocks zone. So it's really exciting. Gets more and more, and I think that's why we have more discussion around extraterrestrials and the possibility, especially with the scientific group. And it's probably why Paul Davies and his assistant over here at ASU decided, you know what, why don't we look at the moon for artificial life of artificial or artifacts of and evidence of visitation from advanced civilizations. I mean, I think their minds are opening from it, and that's what's so exciting, because once we officially confirm life elsewhere, even if it is microbial or very mundane, I think it'll really open people's eyes, because there are still that small group of people out there that say, there probably isn't any life out there beyond our planet at all.
I think you're right. I mean, the smallest type of life discovered, I think, will just open the floodgates. And, I mean, we're already seeing the floodgates open with this new space race. You know, there's renewed interest in exploring space and searching for life. So you've got countries around the world racing against each other, launching all these new programs. And, mm-hmm. you know, even programs that were launched years ago, we're finally getting the data back from that. And that's what's causing this flood of information.
Yeah.
And it just keeps coming. And I know you agree. I mean, it's extremely exciting to me. And, you know, I love seeing the interest that it's causing in not just scientists, but the general public.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're seeing that stuff is being done. And I love that you brought up Paul Davies, and you know, we keep pushing farther and farther out into space, but I love coming back to the moon and looking at the moon,
yeah.
because that needs to be done.
The moon's cool.
I love the moon.
Io is another one. Of course, we've talked about that a lot, Io, or we've known about that for a while, that it's an ice planet, possibly with oceans under the ice. But this is another interesting new discovery. Saturn has a moon that's similar. And I don't know how they say it. Do you know how they say it? Enceladus?
I've heard it pronounced a couple of different ways. The way I pronounce it is Enceladus.
Enceladus sounds like ensalada, which is salad in Spanish. So that kind of sounds weird to me.
Yes, but it should sound normal to you as well.
Like a head of lettuce floating around Saturn.
It there could be some logic to that, my
Enceladon,
friend.
Enceladon? I think because it ends with an N, so maybe Enceladon. Well, I don't know, but they say in these stories that the name is lovely, so whatever way it's said is a lovely way. But regardless, here's another planet kind of like Io with ice, and now they've seen that the ice, the way it's cracking and the way the cracks are moving away from each other look to be fluid, which indicates to them that this ice is covering large liquid oceans. It's probably water, and there could be whale people under there, the civilization of intelligent whale people.
I think what they're finding, and this is the most exciting, is they're finding that the water seems to be quite common. They're finding it everywhere.
Yeah.
Where we used to think that, you know, we can't find water anywhere. But they're finding it everywhere now. And
evidence of it on Mars, on the moon.
Again, back closer to home, they just recently sent a probe to Venus and discovered new features of Venus's surface that they never knew. And that's right here. And
very close.
But then with the recent news of the 10 billion planets, you know, that's just in our galaxy.
Mm-hmm.
And our galaxy, you know, a very tiny representation of the universe.
Yeah. Were you going to talk about, I think we're off this topic now, right?
Yes.
Which is a great topic, and we obviously love the topic.
Well, and I know not all of our listeners do, so I'll stop
boring
people with space.
Hopefully they do, because it's
space
stuff. But the April Fool's joke about Steven Spielberg, did you see that one?
I did not. Why don't you tell me about that?
I can't remember who posted it, but it was pretty funny. It was a story about Steven Spielberg going to space. So, you know, I'm thinking, okay, it's like a lot of these other stories, Katy Perry and her husband, Russell Brand, and all these other people buying tickets either on that SpaceX or with Virgin Galactic to fly up into space. But it says, no, he's going to Mars. And that NASA is going to send a group of people to Mars, and that Steven Spielberg has signed up to be on that first list. It was an April Fool's joke from a story yesterday, but yeah, it was kind of funny. If anybody else has seen that out there, it was had me going for a minute.
I dislike April Fool's Day.
Yeah, I know.
Especially with how easy.
Especially because that one's so exciting.
How easy
and
news
I'm like,
spreads
yes.
now. You know, people pick up on these things,
yeah.
and it is only discovered many hours later that it's.
When it makes sense, and you're thinking, "How cool! We need to do that. We need to go to Mars. Why don't we go to Mars? What's going on? Get to Mars!" Like Arnold Schwarzenegger said.
But Obama's already been to Mars.
Yeah, that's what they say. But even exciting about going to the moon and building a base on the moon as a jumping point to get to Mars. All of this stuff that makes complete sense and would just be so exciting. On the flip side of all of this, of course, we're in a recession. It's hard to justify spending that kind of money. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. The quickest way to the moon or Mars is probably economics. As soon as we get out of a recession, I'm sure money will flow a little more into that industry.
I'm putting all my money on SpaceX. Those guys have it together. Go SpaceX.
Go SpaceX.
All right. Well, you know, in addition to, well, I mean, one of the great things with all of the space news, all of the information coming in from these various NASA and other projects, not only is it getting the media excited, the general public excited, but it's also spurring a lot of, I guess, resurgence in university programs in the science departments. And we're seeing a lot more professors get involved in actively searching for extraterrestrial life.
Hmm.
And I love reading about the various professors who now aren't afraid to admit that they look for extraterrestrial life, or they believe in extraterrestrial life, or they believe in UFOs, things like that. So there is one, and I believe we've talked about him on the show before, but definitely on our website and possibly in the magazine. This is someone from history, but Dr. James E. McDonald was a college professor and the senior physicist for the University of Arizona here in Arizona, obviously, at the Institute of Atmospheric Physics in the 1950s and 60s. He was also intrigued by UFOs and actively investigated the phenomenon. On Friday, the reason I bring this up is on Friday, March 23rd, the Arizona Daily Star published multiple stories from their archives about McDonald and his UFO research. In an article from 1958, McDonald commented on how the scientific community at the time ignored UFO research. He suggested the main reason for this was, quote, the lack of proper data and the ridicule that sometimes followed the man who sees an unidentified object. In 1966, an article titled, UFOs Are Real, Physicist Asserts, highlighted a presentation given by McDonald to more than 200 U.S. faculty members and students, in which he stated that UFOs are most likely, quote, extraterrestrial probes. He based this conclusion on his 10 years of studying unusual atmospheric phenomena, in addition to 6 months specifically investigating UFOs. During the same presentation, McDonald voiced his disgust at the Air Force official investigation into UFOs, Project Blue Book. He referred to Blue Book as a, quote, scientific scandal, and even called into question the scientific competence of the investigators involved. In another article from 1969, McDonald also criticized the Condon Report, which was another Air Force-funded UFO study. The full articles about McDonald can be read on the Arizona Daily Star's website, which is azstarnet.com. I thought that was interesting that they chose to highlight that group of articles from their archives about McDonald. Certainly some interesting stuff in there and a lot more that I didn't get to there. But another college professor who was recently in the news was retired University of Nebraska at Omaha physics professor Jack Kashner. He believes in UFOs and extraterrestrials, and he even recently stated, I'm Catholic, and we believe in angels and things like that. If your religion doesn't allow for the existence of extraterrestrials, then something is wrong with your religion. And he recently was featured on the show NASA's Unexplained Files. It was on the Science Channel as part of their month-long series titled Are We Alone, where they featured several shows about extraterrestrials.
Yeah, he's been out there a lot. On James McDonald, we actually have a story in our last magazine. I can't remember which one it was now.
Maybe. I can't remember.
But with James McDonald. And it actually has pictures from his family that I don't think anybody else has ever seen before. So we have some really good stuff on James McDonald there. Because, he was a important person, professor, who was looking into UFOs. And he had a lot of pull. Because he was so well-respected, and he did a lot of battle and really kind of, I would say, I think people would have different opinions, but really put some of those debunkers to task and make them look a little foolish and showed that they were less than honest at times, and including Phil Klass, who, You know, we had an article actually in the magazine with that was written by Kathleen Martin, where she did some research and put together all of the efforts by Phil Klass to get James McDonald like fired and ridiculed and made fun of, which never actually came to fruition, thank goodness. So, yeah, he was a really important guy in the past. But Jack Kasher, Jack Kasher did a conference recently at the University of Nebraska at Omaha with our guest for next week, David Paris. They were two professors who did this conference. Jack Kasher's been in MUFON. He's the state director for Nebraska for MUFON. And he was one of the first guys to look at the Stan Romanek equations, interesting enough, and he was very amazed. You can see videos from the Congress on that. But, yeah, I guess he worked for NASA for a little while or has done some work with NASA. And he's been on a lot of the TV shows looking at NASA footage and stuff like that. So, yeah, Jack Kasher's, I guess he's retired now. He no longer works at the University of Nebraska, but he's an emeritus and still goes there.
Is he going to be in the upcoming Stan Romanek documentary at all?
I don't know. They have some video from him, I would guess so, but I can't say for sure because I do not know.
Did you happen to catch any of the various shows on the Science Channel?
No, I don't have the Science Channel, and which is probably – I mean, I don't have time to watch much TV or anything so because we're writing all the time, of course. And it's probably better I don't because then I'd spend too much time watching that stuff. I'd be watching Michio Kaku's show and all of these shows this month. So I didn't catch many of those. So I'm not sure even what Jack Kasher talked about. Did you?
The only one I caught was, I believe, part one of the two-part series that was called Alien Encounters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that one predominantly featured Carl Sagan's son, Nick Sagan. And
right.
It was an interesting show. It was really well done, and I didn't watch the entire episode either. I just caught maybe half of it, and really it was just this supposition, basically this what if scenario, mm-hmm. and it was almost like a movie. They put it together, put a premise forward that we detected a UFO coming towards Earth, and it shows what might happen,
mm-hmm.
who might do what preparations would be made, how people would respond, and they sort of walk you through that as the ship approaches, and they say, oh, there's 2 months till contact, and so they talk to Nick Sagan and some other experts and you know, make guesses as to how people would respond. It was mm-hmm. kind of interesting. Other shows have done it before.
Yeah. What did they say? People would be freaking out? Or
they showed some people who were just like kind of only focused on that, and they let the rest of their life go to crap.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, their relationships were falling apart because they were just, like, stuck to their computers watching this thing come.
Mm-hmm. But most people were just kind of living their lives or something.
Well, you had the people, you know, like they depict in, like, Independence Day, where, you know, you have the groups of people who are holding their signs going, mm-hmm. hey, come here, UFOs, we love you.
Yeah.
Various responses, and that's
yeah.
right. I think there would be a wide variety of responses mm-hmm. to something like that.
And, you know, a lot of people say people like us who are into UFOs and do this research are going to be out of a job, but I don't believe that at all.
Yeah.
You know, the media always needs their pundits, and we would be that. I think that, you know, it would be good for all of us who are into this because I think more people will be coming to look for answers, and we'd be able to have wider audiences to share this stuff with, to share all this history and everything that's going on. So I think be a good thing on several levels, you know, depending on what you think might be happening. Of course, if you think they're coming here to blow us up and to eat us, then you wouldn't be as excited about it.
No, probably not. But yeah, there would be a wide variety of responses. And,
uh-huh.
you know, you'd probably... I don't know. I mean, I try to equate it to other things that we, for some reason or another, hear on the news, gets blown into a big story, like, you know, like the various stories from last year of space junk going to crash into Earth. And, you know, the media went nuts with it and freaked people out. Some people were freaked out, but most people thought, it was really a big deal. They'd make a bigger deal of it. So really,
although it is a big deal for NASA and those guys up there. I mean, just I think last week they had to go into the escape pod again and sit in their own weight as space junk flew close to them.
I bet space junk's always flying close to them. There's so much crap up there.
Yeah. Well, supposedly, you know, they can see the small space junk and where it is and how close it's getting to them and everything. So, but yeah, there's another story out there that Lee Spiegel wrote. And I don't know if it's on your list, but I don't want to trumpet your list there. If you've got, because I know you have it laid out, you may want to talk about it later. Can I bring it up now?
You can bring it up, and if it's something that's in my list of chronological stories, I will veto your bringing it up now.
This is a NASA files and stuff that were on the show?
No, absolutely. Talk about it.
Oh, yeah. So, because NASA talked about some of their UFO sightings, too, and some of their, and they even had talked about, like, James McDivitt and his sighting. And this is when I know John Schuessler, who I knew, who was in working with NASA at the time, was around. And this was James McDivitt when he was up, in space. He took some film of an object that he thought was really strange. And the story is, when he got back, they took the video or the film, and he didn't see it again. Later, they released pictures. Here's some of the stuff that they filmed. And he said, well, that's not, you know, the stuff I saw. They're like, oh, yeah, this is everything. And he's like, no, this is not what I saw. And I guess, you know, from people who talked to him, he was upset about it. And he wanted to know where the stuff he filmed was. And they never showed him. And that stuff has never surfaced. So I guess they kind of blew it over and they just lightly went over this in the UFO files, on the NASA UFO files portion of the shows that they were showing. But what was disappointing to Lee Spiegel is that he interviewed James McDivitt back then. And, so he's got all of this audio, and they didn't go talk to McDivitt, who's still alive, to get his perspective on this whole thing about how he's still very concerned that they never showed the film that he filmed. And it's just one of many stories, of course, that get glossed over, let alone Gordon Cooper, who that's what's cool, too, about that. You know, those, if you miss the Congress and you want to get some DVDs, definitely get the Lee Spiegel one because there's some interesting stuff there, including because he also interviewed Gordon Cooper, and he was one of the first guys to interview Gordon Cooper about his UFO sightings. So, of course, another astronaut. So I guess that show was pretty light on the real hard data and the real interesting mysteries behind some of those NASA UFO footages.
Well, and I don't think that surprises anybody, but, you know, they definitely weren't shy about hyping it up like there were going to be these great secrets that came out from people who worked at NASA and were really going to shake things up. But I'm not surprised to hear that they kind of downplayed that.
You know, Bryce Zabel puts it really well, that the media is typically, here's what they're saying, here's what these guys are saying, and, you know, we're going to come down somewhere in the middle. And so the same kind of thing, that, the, you know, playing that middle safe ground. And so you can hype the hell out of something. Here's what we're going to talk about. We're going to talk about aliens and NASA and UFOs and NASA film. And it gets people to watch. And then you show them the intriguing stuff, and then you kind of can wrap it up and be safe by letting the NASA representatives have their piece and say what they think about it.
I'm trying to remember who else was in that show. Story Musgrave was in there.
Right.
Oberg was in there.
So Story Musgrave, we saw at MUFON. He spoke at MUFON. He doesn't believe there's evidence of UFOs or of anything strange visiting us. I asked him personally, well, had you heard the stories? Because he said, I've talked to every astronaut about whether or not, about their UFO sightings. And I found them all to be something that they mistaked something mundane that they mistook as something mysterious. So I asked him particularly, what about Gordon Cooper? Because he had a couple experiences even as a pilot. And he said, yep, I talked to Gordon Cooper. I just don't see what he was saying as something mysterious. And, of course, Gordon Cooper says, when he was in the Air Force in a jet, they saw like seven of these discs fly by their formation of planes. So, of course, how do you explain that? Let alone also when he was working at Edwards Air Force Base, seeing a silver disc land on this test bed and then get up and fly away. And that was a video his guys filmed, which was somebody came and collected it and he never saw it again. So unfortunately, you know, that's about all Story Musgrave would say. He wouldn't, you know, explain himself further as to why he doesn't think those things are mysterious when they sound pretty dang mysterious to me.
You know, people who are set in their beliefs really are not going to change them, especially if they're not open to changing them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, there's not much you can do there. But and it's something that, you know, I think we all have to remind ourselves of when hearing UFO stories and reading UFO sighting reports and things like that is, you know, especially if you've had your own UFO sighting or sightings, that witness testimony, you know, there's so much to put into what the witness says and what they saw, because, you know, even if a video doesn't appear to go along with what you believe, or there's a possible explanation and other videos come forward and say, this is probably what you saw when there wasn't a photo or video at that time. And the person says, no, that's not what I saw. Why are you saying that? What I saw didn't look anything like that. You know, really it comes down to people seeing things personally. And really that's what it takes for a lot of people to believe, is seeing it for themselves.
Right.
So we see that a lot with UFO sightings, and especially when there is no evidence to corroborate their statement. They just have their statement, and through their description, it might sound like it was a flock of birds or something like that. But when people see the video of that demonstrated, they go, no, that's not what I saw at all. Stop saying that's what I saw, because I know what I saw.
Right.
And it can be very frustrating for the people who had the experience.
They get really upset.
Right.
They get downright angry.
Well, they should.
That's right.
I mean, it's good to be open to, you know, trying to find out what possible explanations there could be, but there's a difference between that and being positive about certain characteristics you saw, certain movements or shapes or behaviors. And when someone tries to tell you that you didn't observe that, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
So, well, I want to move into talking about some UFO sightings.
Go for it.
And first, I'll just gloss over this story, but it was big news, so I thought I would bring it up. But pop singer Rihanna, she'll be fighting hostile extraterrestrials in the upcoming Hollywood blockbuster film Battleship. And although this movie will be her big screen debut, Rihanna is not a novice when it comes to watching for UFOs and extraterrestrials. As a child in Barbados, Rihanna reportedly spent considerable time on her family's porch searching the night sky for UFOs. According to The Sun, the singer recently stated, quote, "My dad used to make me sit outside on the steps all night long looking for UFOs flying by, and I had to do that for years." In her years of skywatching, Rihanna claims she saw a shooting star, but no UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that you don't care at all, Alejandro, but Battleship opens in theaters April 11th. I really have no interest in seeing that movie.
But I read those stories and I saw that, but I didn't see anything where she kind of said she believes in UFOs or anything. Did she?
No, didn't see anything.
That's too bad.
And in fact, you know, now that you bring that up, you know, the main source being The Sun, they're not always great at providing information or even...
Oh, that's right.
...stating or
that was interesting, too, that
sure
the Sun was
Sun
the source.
Is actually correct in what they're saying. But.
Yeah. Sun isn't often accurate, and they often are using other people's stories, but this time they did the interview in this case, which was interesting. But, yeah, so they didn't say much. I was kind of hoping – it's kind of cool she talked about her dad, you know, looking at stuff. That's kind of interesting, and at least being brave enough to do that. Of course, it's related to this movie, so – it's kind of one more celebrity to chalk up to all the celebrities that have talked about UFOs and ETs in the last year. Not as exciting as Fran Drescher or Sammy Hagar saying they talk and with aliens and everything. But
yeah, actual encounters. But still, you know, it's another example of...
Yeah.
And, you know, it's likely, or I think it's directly related to the fact that there are so many extraterrestrial-themed movies.
Yeah.
You know, so the topic does come up a lot directly to these people. So
even the Ninja Turtles.
Right.
And which is kind of frustrating because it's like these days, because aliens are in movies so much, it's not a very original concept to have an alien movie. That's one of my gripes with having the Teenage Ninja Turtles reinventing their story where they're aliens. And I don't know how they could think people would get excited because, so what? There's alien movies like crazy. That's not a very creative idea whatsoever.
I'm refraining from getting worked up about...
Oh, I'm getting worked up, baby.
Turtles because we don't know the full story yet. I think they're going to work it in.
Come on.
To where it doesn't disrupt the original story. It just provides a little extra information.
Now, if they still mutate their mutated aliens, that'd be kind of cool. But I don't think they're going to go there. Because they're kind of mini Godzillas. Because that's what Godzilla was he was a mutated from the nuclear waste.
There are so many ways you could do it. You know, it's possible that Master Splinter or someone else, Shredder, could have brought back this toxic ooze from some different planet and lost a canister of the ooze in the sewer.
But they're aliens, so they're not from the planet. So it would have had to have been an alien sewer in
we
this new
invention.
We don't
know that they are aliens. They have extraterrestrial origin.
They're aliens. He said they're aliens.
He doesn't necessarily know.
Maybe not.
He was trying to excite the kids. It was at this children's event for Nickelodeon.
But it's like, ooh, great idea. That's not very original, dude.
No, it's not. And it's not a story that needs reinventing. But
yeah.
Anyway, you're right. It's over the top just trying to make an extraterrestrial movie when every movie is already an extraterrestrial movie. So.
Yep.
Whatever. Well, Alejandro, your favorite UFO is back. You know that triangle-shaped UFO known as the Dudley Dorito? It was spotted again in Yorkshire, north of England, on Monday, March 26th, and was recorded on video. And again, according to The Sun, the sighting marks the fourth appearance of the Dudley Dorito in 5 years, and I'm sure we've mentioned all four of those, possibly even more. It's my personal opinion that every single one of these Dudley Dorito videos I've seen looks so cheesy.
Pun intended?
That pun was quite intended.
Mm-hmm.
They just look goofy to me.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I understand that it could possibly be the TR-3B or whatever that triangle craft is, but this Dudley Dorito, and I think it's the reason they call it the Dudley Dorito, is you always see it, like, flying on its side or at an angle or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be the bottom of the craft, but you always see it with the camera.
Yeah.
Kind of an odd perspective, so... What's your thought on the Dudley Dorito?
Yeah, I don't know. Of course, there are interesting triangular UFO formation videos out there. But yeah, a lot of the ones recently haven't been that impressive either, I don't think. And it's so difficult to see, especially on little videos with YouTube. So it's really hard to say on these things, but no real super-duper ones. Yeah.
That will be the Super Dorito.
Yeah. Super Dorito. Of course, it could be all a publicity stunt
for Doritos.
For the new Dorito tacos at Taco Bell, which now we're advertising for free. And for me, Doritos are a very overpowering taste. So to have it as a taco, that's like, wow, that's sensory overload.
For our friends in the UK, I don't know the answer to this, but do they have Taco Bell in the UK?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, someone in the chat, I'm sure there's you UK people in the chat. Let us know.
Well, let's get into a real sighting here.
Mm-hmm.
So a 12-year-old girl recorded video of a UFO above her home in Penfield, Ohio. And that's approximately 40 miles southwest of Cleveland. That was on Thursday, March 22nd. The aerial object appeared during the day, and when the girl noticed the UFO, she recorded a 43-second video of it hovering in the sky. The object appears to be long and silver and looks almost metallic when reflecting the sun's rays. This UFO has a very shark-like appearance, making it a very peculiar flying object. According to the local ABC affiliate, local police couldn't identify it, So they contacted Homeland Security for assistance with identifying the object. That seems like a pretty drastic jump there to go straight to Homeland Security. But there's a possibility that the object was simply a toy or balloon based on its shark-like appearance. Shark-shaped remote control airplanes and balloons are sold by a few toy manufacturers. An RC plane can be ruled out in this case because of the movement. The object is basically floating. It's not flying or doing things that these shark airplanes do. I'm sure you've seen videos of some of these shark airplanes.
Yeah, the shark airplanes are really cool. I want one.
Yeah.
But the shark balloons, yeah, have just come out more so because they were in the video. There's a popular GIF of a shark balloon floating in behind a cat and scaring this cat. And it's this hilarious video. I love it. But that thing went viral, and they sold out of these things because I went to the website, and I'm like, I got to have one of these. And but they just got a new shipment in, and people have been buying them like crazy. So possible.
Well, it was my opinion that you know, the balloon was the likely identification for this thing. The William Mark Corporation is a company that sells a product called Air Swimmers, and that's probably the company you're referring to. The remote-controlled helium-filled balloons and a flying shark is one of the available models. And while the manufacturer clearly states the product is only for indoor use, it is a pretty easy guess to say that people don't always follow directions, especially manufacturer directions.
I'm sure they get loose.
Oh, yeah. And sometimes a warning like that is just encouragement.
It's, yeah.
Saying,
well, what'll
on,
happen?
Come on.
And what they realize is there's no control to make it go down and come back to the ground.
Right.
It's
it'll get away from
up
you.
And up and up.
And there you go. And your remote's not going to be able to pull it down.
Yeah.
Out of range. And coincidentally, I thought this was interesting. That same company, they used to make a product called My Mysterious UFO.
Oh, really?
This little remote-controlled UFO.
Oh,
kind
cool.
Of interesting. And I just found this out today, that after some investigating, the sheriff's office determined that the UFO was, in fact, a remote-controlled shark. The girl who shot the video of the object doesn't agree with the police, though. And this is exactly what we were just talking about, Alejandro. She claims the object she saw when she was shooting the video was as big as a semi, while the remote-controlled sharks are only approximately 5 feet long.
Hmm.
So she says, no way was this thing, this little shark balloon.
Oh, really? Well, that is interesting. That's a hard part, because you have the witness testimony, and is the witness just mistaken, or is the witness not mistaken, and something extraordinary took place?
The witness is only 12 years old, but I do know some sharp 12-year-olds, so I will not...
Maureen put a link to the video on our chat. So people will have to, hilariousgifts.com, cat attack by shark balloon is what it's called.
It's not hilarious, that's sad, poor cat.
It's not a real shark, it's the air swimmer balloon.
It's a real cat, and it's real fear.
The video's hilarious, just because there's a cat, and then it pans back, and it's shocking the first time you see it, because you see this shark behind the cat, and it's like swimming. Oh, it's funny.
You're mean.
It's not really eating the cat, Jason.
All right. But so the police do think that it was a shark balloon that got away. And if you watch the original video, it does look like a shark. I mean, that's what it looks like. And you watch video of these air swimmer sharks, that's exactly what it looks like. So it's quite possible and quite probable that one did get away. And also, from the ground, and depending on how far away this was, it's difficult to tell size and distance when you're on the ground looking at an object in the sky. So
it's another possibility, though, is that somehow this air swimmer got a sophisticated artificial intelligence put into it, and it is out there self-aware, swimming around in the sky, creating havoc and up to no good.
All right, Michael Bay, you need to calm down. All right. Here's another sighting. On March 24th, Burbank, Washington resident Mike Klug saw what he described as a slow-moving orb with a bright reddish-orange light inside it. Having never witnessed anything like it, he grabbed his camera and recorded video of the strange object. His house is directly under the flight path of the nearby airport, so Klug says he is familiar with the appearance of airport traffic. But this orb did not behave like anything he had seen before. He estimated that the object was, quote, no more than 500 feet off the ground and was moving at 15 miles an hour east towards Walla Walla. Peter Davenport of the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington reportedly reviewed Klug's video, but according to the Tri-City Herald, Davenport dismissed the orb as simply Sirius, also known as the Dog Star.
Is he serious?
Based on the object's position in the sky. And I don't know, it's tough reading just by written word what actually took place here, but to me it seemed like Davenport was too quick to dismiss the video and didn't listen to the backstory to this guy and why his witness testimony should count more. He even posted additional video or took additional video from days prior to this event of another weird object in the sky, but he was able to identify it. The individual in Washington, Klug, was able to identify it himself as an ultralight. So he'd seen ultralights, he'd seen helicopters, airplanes, he observed these things in the sky, and living by an airport, saw weird stuff all the time. So Davenport quickly assumed that it was probably Sirius. And that doesn't make any sense to me based on witness testimony, because the guy described this thing being, you know, 500 feet off the ground. It's difficult to tell altitude, again. Mm-hmm. So who knows about that? But he described the object as moving.
Well, it sounds to me, I mean, just from listening, exactly like a Chinese lantern, of course, which we've flown around because they have a little light in the middle. And moving slowly, 15 miles per hour would probably be about right, depending on the gusts.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Sirius doesn't seem to make sense. Another reason why is that Jupiter is out there, extremely bright, not too far from Sirius. Right next to Jupiter is Venus, which is out there, which is extremely bright. They're very near each other right now. If you go especially right at dusk, after dusk, when it gets dark, you're going to see them up in the sky, really bright. And then a couple hours after dusk, Saturn is coming up. And Saturn is as bright as Sirius is right now. And those are all, well, not so much Jupiter, but especially Venus and Saturn are different colors than the regular stars, where a star isn't going to really appear to be orange or reddish. So
right.
Sirius really doesn't make any sense, except for maybe the direction he was looking. But Sirius is going to move so slow, it's not going to look like it's moving no 15 miles an hour. In fact, you're not going to be able to know it's moving unless
right.
you sit there and watch for
right.
half an hour or put your telescope on it. So that one is a hard one. Yeah, I've been looking up at the sky a lot lately, and I got some really cool video, actually, of Saturn with my telescope. But where I can actually see the rings, so that was real exciting, something
that
I
is
did
cool.
this week. But, so, you know, that doesn't really – Sirius is not the most exciting thing in the sky right now, by far. Jupiter and Venus and Mars is the other one that you can see right now in the sky, which is red. I mean, that would be a little more plausible. So, yeah, I don't know that I'm buying the Sirius thing, but – sounds like, yeah, this might be, you know, who knows, especially that's what people by airports and in urban areas I think is really interesting. They are more savvy because they're seeing lights in the sky all the time. You know, they're seeing planes, they're seeing helicopters on a regular basis, so they know what that stuff is.
So when you see something that's out of the ordinary,
yeah.
it definitely catches your attention.
Yeah, and it probably is, and something that isn't ordinary, even if it is mundane, not ordinary.
But I will say, in Peter Davenport's defense, you know, I know the guy must be completely inundated.
Oh yeah,
with
he's one man.
And videos all the time.
He's one guy who gets as many videos or reports almost as MUFON. Not. He used to get more reports to MUFON.
Right. And I do know, and it's an unfortunate thing that happens, but, you know, after being flooded for a while
yeah.
with stuff, you become quite cynical, I think.
Yeah, look at us.
And, you know, I mean, you look at something, you're all, eh, Chinese lantern.
Yeah,
eh,
I know.
Star. So, I mean, he was recently interviewed by the Tri-City Herald, and he said, we look at many, many, many photographs and videos, and 99.99999% of them are not UFOs.
Yeah.
And he said, most of them are photographic hogwash.
Oh, geez, that's a little strong.
So,
but it
yeah.
is disheartening because, you know, as we know and we talk on the show all the time about these videos, we get hate letters saying, oh, I can't believe you did that. It's not a UFO. But, I mean, it's not that we're looking to debunk everything. Certainly not. We're looking for the truth to try
right.
to find out, you know, something that is incontrovertible and so we can truly understand the nature. But when you get these things that you got to, you know, that there is an explanation for it, you got to say so. You can't just kind of believe what you want when evidence points otherwise.
You lose your credibility.
And especially with us, and we both feel this way, we're certainly not the end-all, be-all.
Our
opinions
not.
Are solely our
and
opinions.
And that's the thing. With most of the evidence that we have
yeah.
that is available with the majority of these sightings, it can be interpreted so many ways.
Yeah. And I certainly, and I know you feel the way, we appreciate other opinions. And
absolutely.
It's great that people
I
have other opinions.
I love, and I search out other opinions.
Yeah.
You know, my opinions are based off of what I see on a daily basis and what I've encountered with other sightings, with other similar evidence.
Right.
And in my own personal testing and things like
yeah.
that we do. You know, that's all we can do. We can take what we've encountered in the past and use that, apply that towards mm-hmm. the current piece of evidence in front of us. And make our best assumption,
yeah.
but it's still
and
an
I
assumption.
Mean, but we the and we do our due diligence around, you know, launching balloons and seeing what they look like. You know, spending time sky watching, filming flares and things like that, so we can give ourselves a little bit more of an educated opinion.
Because again, it's the personal experience. It's seeing something for yourself
yeah.
firsthand. You know, I can watch videos and have people say, this is what this was, or look at this. This is, you know, bugs in the camera lens. But until I go out and do those tests for myself and see, wow, that's actually plausible. You know, I don't believe it. So I understand
yeah.
that. And I think it's important for us to do those tests
yeah.
to be able to find that out so we can make, you know, coherent arguments and based on something rather than just talking out our behinds.
That's right.
Don't panic. But one thing that I disagree with Peter Davenport, he also said this. He said, virtually everything that is published in newspapers about UFOs are not worth the time it takes to read.
Mm-hmm.
If it makes it into the newspaper, it's probably not a real case. And again, I think that's pretty harsh. I mean, more and more we are seeing more articles about UFO sightings and but I guess more than sightings, we see articles about researchers, about events, things like that. I know there's lots of talk about lots of articles about professors doing research into
yeah.
into extraterrestrial life. Also, I mean, when Leslie Kane's book came out, there was a lot of positive press that was printed in newspapers
yeah.
and digging more into the backstories, the smaller stories, and certainly here in Phoenix, there was some good coverage. And additional stories on Phoenix City Councilman Francis Barwood and talking about Governor Fife Symington, people who witnessed the Phoenix Lights,
yeah.
and talking about how there is the lack of an official organization to investigate UFOs.
Yeah. Well, if he's talking about videos, though, I would kind of have to agree with him. I wouldn't say not worth reading because they are worth reading. But they do, especially The Sun, like we've been criticizing, and others, they pick up and sensationalize these things when they're obviously not something exciting. Recently in Phoenix, and it made national news, there was a V-shaped blue light flying around that looked like a kite, was most likely a kite. But, you know, the media picked it up and made a big deal out of this UFO, and then, of course, MUFON does the research and finds out it is a kite with LEDs. So they do pick up on some stories to sensationalize, even if sometimes they aren't something that, you know, will turn out to be truly unknown. But still, a lot of times these guys are just trying to figure out themselves. They're not, you know, they get a video from a citizen who's very excited about what they filmed, and they give them respect and often do this in a respectful way, show the film and talk about, oh, wow, look at this mystery, I wonder what that is, later to find out maybe sometimes it's an RC plane or something. So often these videos that show up in the news turn out to be something mundane, but not always.
Well, and I guess it's probably more important for me as a researcher and a UFO news reporter to pay attention to the articles
that
are published in the paper for the main reason of just observing how these things are being covered by the mainstream media, seeing how that changes over time, and you know, seeing what information they're putting out, what and what they're doing in the particular cases, because that helps too to see how serious they're taking it. You know, if they contacted the FAA in certain cases, and I mean there's things that I find interesting as somebody who follows this.
Yeah.
But for you know, just someone else looking to find information about a UFO sighting, mm-hmm. I guess it's probably true. And in most of the cases, there's not really good information in a lot of the stories, so it might not be worth reading. But
stories that aren't related to videos are often very good, like you're talking about. Like the Congress stuff that we had, the coverage we got for the Congress was very good, I think, this year. But, you know, still one of the best videos, I think, and one of the best stories – personally, UFO stories to come out, which didn't really make that big of a buzz nationally or outside of local, though, we talked about is that Tucson sighting. Remember when that Tucson reporter saw during the day this blue light up in the sky, and he filmed it, and that has we've never gotten an answer for that. Nobody knows what that is. Highly credible, I think, because it was this news cameraman who was filming it, you know, and he saw it while they were on the job. I think that's one of the most mysterious. That's a great video.
I do, too. And you're right. That one didn't get very much attention. But that was definitely one of the most bizarre sightings.
Daylight sighting.
Incredible. Yeah.
What the heck is that?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, Alejandro, I want to talk now about another mysterious sighting.
Bum, 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 bum.
So an interesting video was brought to my attention on Friday, actually, by our good friend and Huffington Post journalist Lee Spiegel. The video was recorded by a tourist from Ohio, and it shows a mass of small orb UFOs above Las Vegas on the night of Wednesday, March 21st. Coincidentally, Lee and I were actually in Las Vegas on the night of March 21st, and if we would have been outside on the strip instead of enjoying the buffet together, we might have seen this, actually. But the video shows...
Fail.
It's not my fault. Lee was hungry.
Yeah.
The video shows approximately 7.5 minutes of mysterious illuminated orbs swirling in and around the Luxor sky beam above the Luxor Las Vegas. The Las Vegas Sun describes, quote, several bright spots of light can be seen rotating in a fixed pattern high above the strip near the Luxor's famous beam of light. The exact time of the event is unknown, but when you listen to the video, you can hear the witness's wife or girlfriend or a woman he's with continually nagging him, saying, come on, we've got to go. We've got tickets. Let's go. We're going to miss the show.
Who is the comedian?
George Wallace.
Yeah.
So they had tickets.
So it's right before the
George Wallace
show.
And she kept saying, we're going to be late. And the guy's all, forget George Wallace. This is better than George Wallace.
She's like, they're
$100. She's all, well, maybe, but it's not better than $110.
Yeah.
So what I did was I went, George Wallace performs at the Flamingo Showroom. So I went on the Flamingo's website and found out what his show times are.
Cool.
And he performs at 10 p.m. So exciting. Must have occurred sometime just before 10 p.m.
Yeah.
So the witness uploaded his video to his YouTube channel, which he titled UFOs with a Z. UFOs are very real. And as is the case with a lot of these more interesting UFO videos, the channel was created specifically for this video. There's only this one video on the channel, which sometimes is a red flag, not necessarily in this case. But so with this video, he added the description that says, the event I captured in this video changed my life forever. Pretty powerful. But not everyone is convinced that the objects in the video merit such awe. Some suggest that the objects in the video are simply bats or birds flying around and into the beam of light. One YouTube user commented, "Dude, I work at Mandalay Bay, which is right next door to the Luxor. They are bats and birds that eat the bugs that are attracted to the bright light in the beam coming from the Luxor. It happens almost every night in the spring and summer, and I have seen it ever since the light has been on. It's not a UFO." Of course it's not a UFO. It's many UFOs. But.
Totally, dude.
But the Las Vegas Sun reports that two other videos posted by separate people were uploaded to YouTube on March 22nd, possibly showing the same event but from different angles. The object in the video are only visible when illuminated by the powerful light beam from the Luxor. And this, my opinion is that that paired with the sort of gliding motion of the objects, it certainly makes the theory of bats or birds plausible. But again, with the limited detail provided by the video, it's impossible to make a positive identification. But looking at these things swirling only around the light and kind of going into the light and all staying in the same area and only being illuminated when they're close to the light, it doesn't seem like a flying craft of any sort. And it certainly makes sense that it would be a bat. And you can imagine I like to call it a buffet of bugs that's in this light beam. So, you know, bats come to Vegas for the buffet too.
Right. And I feel bad because the guy who took the video is going to be really mad at us if he ever hears us saying this, because he's definitely unhappy with the theory of birds and bats. But, you know, he was quite a distance away. He was down the street, you know, halfway down the strip practically when he's filming this thing. So you could definitely see the beam. He's not denying it's a beam. So either very small orbs are attracted to the light of the Luxor, or, these things are definitely being lit up by the beam of light. They're only just above the beam. There's a lot of them, granted, and they're moving in a circular formation. But I being someone who's camped and lived in the Southwest, at least in New Mexico and Colorado, I've seen this. Sports, I've been to Carlsbad where you see for half an hour huge, groups of bats coming out and in a circular formation like that. You know, they fly around like a tornado. But I've also been in Colorado where, you know, you kind of hear them or something and you flash your flashlight up and there's just tons of them right above you. You don't even know they're there until you flash your flashlight up and you see them swirling around like that and catching bugs and stuff. So I think it was at the right place at the right time where just a bunch of them came in. And they do that in the desert, you know. They come in, they feed, and then they go back to their cave, wherever their cave is. And so he was at the right place at the right time and caught them. You know, they were, like you said, having a smorgasbord. They're like jackpot. And unfortunately, that's really, I'm sure. And if we were able to look closer at the video, we'd probably be able to see that for sure. There are some other videos. This isn't the first guy to be fooled. I saw at least one other, where it's very clearly birds because he's right next door to the Luxor. And you can see the wings flapping. But this guy was not convinced. He's like, no, those are UFOs attracted to the light of the Luxor flying through. But if you watch the video, you can see they're birds. He could have been goofing around or something. But so he doesn't seem like the first to be tricked. But unfortunately, you know, whatever is it's lit by the light. And
it's a great video to watch. You should watch it. There are tons of these.
I watched it on my phone, and I couldn't see the light from the Luxor, so I was really bored. I'm like, wow, what the heck is this?
I watched it on a small screen first as well, and it just looks incredible because you see all of these white dots kind of moving around the sky, and it looks incredible. But on a larger screen, you can see them moving around the beam from the Luxor.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to Vegas a couple times this month, so if I get a chance, I'm hoping to take my camera out and shoot up towards the Luxor and see if I see anything. Not that the bats are always feasting, but, you know, if I happen to catch that, you know, and get a good shot, then I can determine more and compare the videos. But
you're going out to Vegas a lot lately. Are you like a, do you stand in for some of these showgirls or something? Do you have a side job of
I have many professions, and because I'm a secret agent and I work at Area 51, I have my secret jobs at the casinos, yes.
Oh, we got to get to that Area 51 stuff.
Oh, we'll get to Area 51 in just a little bit.
All right.
Yeah, we can actually talk about it now if you want.
Are you? Do you have more news stories?
Well, that's the next story that I'd like to talk
about. Oh, okay, go for it.
So, as I just mentioned, I was in Vegas, and I was with our good buddy Lee Spiegel.
Right.
And we were both out there for wasn't the official opening. It was a media event to announce the opening, which I think today was the opening.
Oh, really?
Maybe it was. I don't remember. But the National Atomic Testing Museum in Las Vegas just opened an Area 51 exhibit. And so they had a press event where they invited us out, and they had a nice little press conference. But more importantly, they let us walk through the exhibit. And the thing I enjoyed most about walking through this exhibit, and I'll get to the exhibit in a minute, but was the ability to talk to the people behind the exhibit, the curator there and the person who runs the museum, and get their take on it and really find out what their objective was with this exhibit and why they decided to open an Area 51 exhibit. First of all, I was most surprised by the attention that the exhibit gives to UFOs and extraterrestrials.
You wouldn't think so at the National Atomic Museum. You know, you'd think they'd be all about the science and stuff. But, behold.
So, yeah, this is the National Atomic Testing Museum. It's a fairly new museum. I think it just opened in 2005. So it's pretty new, and it's really nice. You know, when I was coming up to the place, I was expecting to, you know, a lot of Vegas is kind of old and run down. So I was expecting this National Atomic Testing Museum to be crammed in some nasty warehouse next to or sandwiched between some nasty strip clubs.
Mm-hmm.
But the building is brand new, basically. Everything is
not nasty.
Squeaky clean and shiny. I saw nothing nasty about it.
No strippers?
Well, the media event did have some free alcohol. So there were men in black there. And one of the men in black accidentally dumped his drink on the floor.
Oh, really?
And these drinks, I forget what they called them, but they were this toxic green. So there was this toxic green sludge all over the floor.
Oh, my gosh.
He got it on his suit, too. I felt bad for him. He was a really nice guy, actually.
So was he just some media person, or was he someone that they had dressed like that?
The museum had Men in Black on staff.
Cool.
Yes. They also had an ugly extraterrestrial, too.
Yeek.
They seemed to be buddies, though.
Good.
But they both work at the museum, so.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was something like that. And I know some people would be turned off by the fact that they have that. And I think that's a regular part of the museum they're going to have. And you know, when I walked in, they definitely had inflatable extraterrestrials,
mm-hmm.
balloons there in front of the exhibit. And so I could tell that they were definitely playing up to that audience, and that's what they want. And it makes sense. But, you know, when you get into the exhibit, and see just how much they're pushing, or not pushing, but, you know, featuring UFOs. And not just UFOs, but the search for extraterrestrial life. You know, they have an installation there talking about SETI, about Seth Shostak, about the efforts of the SETI Institute. They have things talking about various NASA initiatives, you know, that definitely caught me by surprise. I wasn't expecting that at all, because what does that have to do with Area 51?
Mm-hmm.
So I think they definitely took liberties wherever they could to try to put this stuff in there. You know, because they really, it seems to me that they want to raise public awareness about the reality of UFOs and extraterrestrials.
Well, what was the UFO type of stuff they had there? I mean, was it actual research? Like, was it Bob Lazar stuff, or was it Roswell stuff?
So they definitely have that.
Uh-huh.
You know, that is an aspect of the exhibit. And, you know, they have little Roswell stuff here and there, even in the decor. You know, they've got, like, kind of silvery memory metal hanging from the walls and stuff like that. But they also have a little installation about George Knapp, who is based in Las Vegas. So he was able to work with them on the exhibit, actually. And this is probably, for our listeners and for people interested in UFOs in general, this is probably the highlight of this exhibit. Pretty incredible. Is a piece or samples from an alleged crashed UFO in Russia that is known as the Russian Roswell that occurred, I think, in 1986. And George Knapp went over and investigated that, and he smuggled back samples with him. And those samples have been tested by quite a few people. And what's interesting is at the museum, they have this on display with, I think, some of the test results too. And this was provided by George Knapp to the museum. And at the exhibit, they have it displayed at, or labeled as authentic alien artifact.
Really?
And, you know, I think they're trying to be tongue-in-cheek with that, but it's not, you know, they don't say, just kidding, or anything. I mean, that's on the sign. That's how it's displayed.
There's no
and
JK on it.
I didn't point this out earlier, but this National Atomic Testing Museum is affiliated with the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm.
It is a Smithsonian museum.
Right.
So that's a pretty bold claim to make in a Smithsonian museum, to say that this is an authentic alien artifact.
Yeah, this is a serious museum. I'm sure everything else in there is real, you know, NASA or
so, right, there's a lot of NASA stuff. There's certainly stuff.
Military stuff.
Stuff from, you know, that actually, you know, that we know has been disclosed that took place at Area 51,
mm-hmm.
like the Oxcart program, the
right.
development of the A-12 that became the SR-71 Blackbird.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they have models of those planes on there. The models are pretty cool because they're like this big, but
mm-hmm.
but you know, they definitely have that. But again, I think the majority of the exhibit is about this UFO stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And back to this authentic alien artifact, it's really cool. And Lee Spiegel actually did a piece on this on the Huffington Post, pointing out some of the test results or some of the statements made by people who tested this stuff. And what the samples are is they're described as very small, perfectly round and glassy spheres.
Hmm.
And the exhibit's description explains that scientific tests on the UFO materials revealed strange behavior. This is what it says. Three Soviet academic centers and 11 research institutes analyzed the objects from this UFO crash. The distance between atoms is different from ordinary iron. Radar cannot be deflected or cannot be reflected from the material. Elements in the material may disappear and new ones reappear after heating. One piece disappeared completely in front of four witnesses. The core of this material is composed of a substance with anti-gravitational properties.
Holy.
That's big time stuff.
Yeah, that's crazy.
And it's on display in
mm-hmm.
the Area 51 exhibit.
Wow.
So
I hope they have it under armed guard.
Well, they've got the extraterrestrial. They've got the men in black there. I think that's their security.
So. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, and I think they're doing a good job. And, again, I mentioned this earlier, but back to the point of, you know, the men in black and, you know, all this lightheartedness they have with the exhibit. I know some people will be turned off by that, but I think it's done in a tasteful way. This is an exhibit, and it's a very small museum, and they're trying to attract people. And this is Las Vegas. You know, people are going to be there with their kids looking for something to do. This makes it a fun, appealing thing to do. So they come in, they get to see,
mm-hmm.
you know, the silly aliens and stuff. But I think it's a great, great way, and it's done in the right way to bring people in but still present the serious side to it. And talking with the curator, Karen, she is very much into the science of UFOs, and they're very much into generating or increasing the public's interest and trying to get people to think about UFOs, the science of UFOs, and doing more research into it, finding out what these things are and why isn't the government doing more to investigate UFOs, or are they telling us everything? I mean, they're definitely trying to pique the public's interest and get people involved in the research of UFOs.
Cool.
And that was my favorite part of being there is talking with the curator and talking with the people and hearing their personal views on it and hearing what they want to accomplish with the exhibit. So after going there, after talking with them and seeing what they have to offer, you know, I wholeheartedly support what they're doing there. And even beyond the exhibit itself, what they have lined up to encourage people to come and check out the exhibit is they're going to have special events throughout the year that involve special speakers to come in and give presentations at the museum. Some of those include Seth Shostak from the SETI Institute, John Alexander, and the one I'm most interested in.
So John Alexander is going to talk about UFOs, and I mean he believes they're real.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely.
Nice.
And this is the one that I'm really excited about, and I'm really? Sure you will be too. Mm-hmm. I don't know about this too much about it yet because I don't even know if they have their speakers lined up. I'm sure they have some of them, and I forget the exact title of it. But it's something like military men who believe in UFOs.
Wow.
So that's going to be a great nice. Presentation. It's going to have several people. And I think that one is sometime later in the year, like September or something like that.
Cool.
But that's definitely something I want to go and check out. So.
Very cool.
But I think they're doing the right things. And their hope is that the exhibit will be well-received and they'll be able to – They have the space available too. They're wanting to expand it and add more. They've got more to add to this exhibit,
mm-hmm.
but they're waiting to see how well it does to then expand and possibly keep this as a permanent exhibit.
That's pretty cool, pretty exciting. And you said they were real nice and they didn't treat you like a redheaded stepchild. One, because you've got the mohawk, or because you are working for some UFO magazine.
I think they assumed I was with the CIA.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, I look pretty nice, and I was asking all the right or wrong questions.
Uh-oh. Dun-dun-dun. Yeah. So cool. That's pretty exciting. Now, they had a board of speakers there, right?
They did.
And did any of those guys talk about UFOs, or were those just kind of people? I know there are some people who work for Area 51, right?
Yeah, they're really – nobody really talked about the UFOs. You know, there was T.D. Barnes, who worked at Area 51. He worked on the Oxcart program. And Lee Spiegel, you know, was very good about putting the question to him.
Taking him to the task there, huh?
Right. So, he definitely pushed him. He said, well, what about the UFOs? And, I mean, he eventually wore him down, and, you know, he was being very cagey, and there were other Area 51 guys there, too. And they all had convenient answers, were dodging the question and in not-so-creative ways. But eventually T.D. Barnes said, well, sure, I guess anything's possible.
Mm-hmm.
But just sort of gave that non-committal answer.
Because these guys will say, oh, Oxcart. That's what created the UFO craze, because people were seeing our pre-SR-71 or type of technology. But they'll also admit that, you know, their projects are secret and they can't see the other projects. They don't work
right.
on the other projects, so they don't know what else is going on there.
And I will say this, T.D. Barnes is a very cool guy and he's got a lot to say, and he's somebody that we should definitely talk to.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a lot of information.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I found some of their answers to be conflicting with each other. They certainly were. You know, I don't know if they were trying to dodge questions or you know, push out answers that they had convinced themselves of. But you're right. You know, they've got these – they say that, oh, you know, well, we only were told about the projects we were working on, and that's all we were allowed to know. That's all we needed to know. We didn't know anything else that was going on there. But then they would also say – 30 seconds later, that, oh, yeah, well, if something would have been brought on the base, we would have known. So, well, wait a second. You just said you didn't. You weren't supposed to know. You weren't
right.
told anything. You only knew what you had to know.
Mm-hmm.
So how was it not possible that something was brought on the base that you did not know about?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I've talked to a guy. I've told this story maybe, I don't know, on the air before, but a guy who worked at Schriever's Air Force Base, which is a top secret base, and they have lots of projects. And, you know, there was a document that came out that possibly
there was some UFO research going on there. And this engineer said, ah, there's no way. You know, I work there. I would know. And so I asked him, well, aren't all the projects there top secret? Yeah. Do you even know what the guy next to you, everything he's working on? And he thought about it for a second. He's like, no. So I said, wouldn't it be possible if one of the things he was working on or a few desks away someone was working on would be a UFO project and that you wouldn't know because you're not supposed to? And that really turned on the light for him because he was more open-minded. And he thought, wow, yeah, that is completely possible. So I guess I wouldn't have any idea, which is the same case it seems here. Yeah, they wouldn't really know. They're just not admitting to themselves they wouldn't know, but they wouldn't really know.
Right. One of the guys told a story of how, you know, when like carpenters or some workers were brought on the base, that all of the Area 51 workers were taken and sort of locked up in the mess hall.
Wow.
Because they, in the story that he said, the reason for that was because they didn't want the workers coming on the base to interact with the Area 51 workers.
Mm-hmm.
But you could turn that around and say just as easily they didn't want the workers to see what was being brought on the base.
Yeah.
You know, how do they know what was going on if they were locked up in this room? So.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
And another interesting thing that was brought up during the press conference, somebody, and I don't remember who asked the question, but somebody asked the question of the panel, asking about the Janet Airlines, the Janet flights that supposedly take workers out to Area 51 from Vegas. And nobody seemed to know anything about Janet Airlines except that it was Janet Airlines. They didn't know it had any, or they wouldn't say there was any connection between Area 51. And they remarked that when they worked there, they were bused to Area 51.
Huh. So. Interesting.
Yeah, but when I did leave Vegas, I saw two of the Janet Airlines sitting outside of their hangars.
That's pretty cool, and that's the first time you've been able to see them.
I've seen them one other time.
Oh, you did.
But yeah, one other time at the airport. But this, every time I go there, I look and try to see them because I know generally where their hangar is, where they're. But this time, two of the planes were just sitting out there.
Cool.
Kind of waved at them.
Did you get a picture?
No, no picture.
Waved at them.
It was during takeoff, Alejandro. Yeah. Your electronics are supposed to be off.
That's right. Yeah.
That screwed me on the way in too, because Air Force One was also at the airport when I landed.
Oh, that's right. So. Bummer. So yep. You didn't pull a Alec Baldwin.
I'm going to. You know, I keep missing out on these camera opportunities.
Yeah. Well, guess what? We're like pretty much out of time, buddy.
Yes, we are.
All right. Well, thank you so much for the news. You went over, so now we can't have our guest Matt Damon on.
I am more important than Matt Damon.
Yeah. So, sorry, Matt Damon. We'll have you on another time.
Sometime. He'll be our backup.
Yeah, but we are out of time. Thank you, Jason McClellan, for the news.
It's been my pleasure, Alejandro. Thank you.
Did you have any other closing statement?
Alejandro for president.
Now let the big guy take that one. Anyhow, thanks so much for listening again. I want to mention yet again, because I'm so excited about it, next week's guest, who is David Paris, and he is the one who works with Dr. Jack Kasher, who Jason was referring to earlier. He's also a University of Nebraska professor, and he teaches all kinds of different disciplines, astronomy and physics and all the cool stuff. So this guy has a lot of degrees, very smart guy. In fact, hopefully I'll be able to understand all the technology that he's talking about. I'm sure he's going to be going over my head with a lot of this stuff. But if you're science-minded and into the science of this stuff, tune in and hear why, you know, this professor believes in UFOs. He believes that they're probably extraterrestrial in nature, and the technology he believes that they're using, and why he's so adamant about, you know, getting this information out there. They even had their own little conference a few weeks ago where him and Jack Kasher presented some of this stuff and their ideas. And we also talk about, which I think is cool, other paranormal phenomena and how it relates to UFO phenomena scientifically, you know, the different types of energies and stuff that are measured and devices that are used, because he's also a ghost hunter. Him takes his students out and their student organization look at all kinds of different paranormal phenomena. So it's going to be a great show. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to visit UFO Daily News and openminds.tv for the latest in UFO news. And we will talk to you next week, people.